Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Agile Ideas. Joining us today is very special guest, Shane Delia. Shane is best known as the founder and director of restaurants Maha, Maha East, Maha Bar, and Biggie Smalls. Shane is a television presenter, host of his own TV show, Spice Journey and Recipes for Life, author of Maha Middle Eastern Home Cooking and Spice Journey, and a charity and brand ambassador. Since 2016, Shane has been a presenter on Channel 9's Postcards, Victoria's most popular travel and lifestyle show. Shane's flagship restaurant, Maha, has gone from strength to strength since its inception in 2008. Renowned for its fresh, unrestricted Middle Eastern menu, the Age Good Food Guide has continuously recognized Maha as a leader in its field, awarding the restaurant one hat annually since 2009. 2020 brought to life Maha Bar, a cool and classic venue reimagines what Meze Bar could be with an undeniable Melbourne spirit. Shane's larger-than-life personality and enthusiasm for food and Australian culture is captured in his acclaimed television program, Spice Journey. After a successful third season, Spice Journey has aired in 135 countries across five continents and continues to be an Australian and international success. In 2018, Shane was personally selected by Joseph Muscat, who at the time was the Prime Minister of Malta, to become a member of the Council for Maltese Living Abroad. Shane is extremely passionate and proud of his Maltese heritage. Outside of hospitality, Shane has curated a portfolio of significant local and international brands that he is proudly an ambassador of. These brands include Mercedes-Benz Australia, Western Bulldogs, Melbourne City Football Club, and Host Plus. Thank you so much for joining today. Really appreciate your time and really hoping to get some insights and guidance on your career and what you've done so far. Maybe just from a perspective of starting on a really positive note, considering the environment and the circumstances we're in, what was the most positive thing that happened to you last week?
The most positive thing that happened to me last week, I made dumplings with my daughter.
Beautiful. Not those Turkish beef dumplings.
No. Just some pork and chicken dumplings with some XO sauce.
Beautiful. Those beef dumplings were part of our order recently and they were absolutely delicious. I would order them 100 times over. So thank you. I've never had them before. They were very, very delicious. So really excited about that. So most people would already know you as one of Australia's best chefs. One of the things that I think some people may not know is that earlier on in your career, you became Australia's youngest executive chef of a five-star property at the Chateau Yering, which is amazing. Did you always know that you wanted to be a chef when you were younger?
Yes, I was lucky. I kind of knew what I wanted to do straight away. So I knew from the time I was about 14 years old that I wanted to be a chef, and the worry about, you know, what I was going to study or what I was going to be, and when everybody else was thinking about what they wanted to do, I was already, you know, pretty determined to follow my passion.
Beautiful. And I know you went straight into the hotel Sofitel, and that's where you completed your apprenticeship before ending up working in the Yarra Valley, which is an amazing place to probably get that work experience and actually getting an opportunity there. How did that come about? Did you just do what regular people do and apply? Did you have some good contacts as a result of your work experience?
No, I didn't. I didn't start at the Sofitel. I applied at every five-star hotel in the country.
Wow.
But I had to write, you know, I write a letter. I mean, I wasn't sending emails.
Yes.
And as a 15-year-old kid, I was denied and turned down from every job I applied for. And then I eventually got a job at a hotel called Eden on the Park, just next to Albert Park Lake, because I did some work experience there and I, you know, was washing dishes and doing everything else, and they decided to give me a chance. And then from there, I just took every opportunity that was in front of me and worked my way up to the Sofitel, which was a bit of a turning point in my early career.
Beautiful. Oh, amazing. I think it's some good guidance for those out there that are looking for work at the moment is like, don't give up and actually go and just apply. I used to sit there for 8 hours a day applying for work when I was early on in the career as well. So it's actually a really good initiative that you took to actually reach out to them. That's amazing. Where do you get your cooking inspiration from? I know that you do a lot of Middle East and Mediterranean, but where do you typically get your inspiration from for all your different dishes that you do?
Produce, I think produce leads the way a lot of the time, especially now. I mean, inspiration and menu styles change over the years, over the seasons. Obviously there's business decisions that need to take place as well, and different, we do a lot of different mediums. We've got, restaurants like Maha, which is our premium venues, and then we've got venues like Middle Ground, which is a QSR brand at the airport, and Biggie Smalls, a kebab place, and a mezze bar and a wine bar. So I mean, menu inspiration takes many forms depending on what the medium is. But I think we just try to create our own style of food. I mean, we call it like unrestricted Middle Eastern, because we don't have any boundaries as to where we can draw inspiration from. But primarily we let the produce speak louder, and not worry so much about what's traditional and what's not traditional.
Beautiful. You mentioned Biggie Smalls, which is a restaurant that I'm fascinated with. Obviously, that must tie into your love of hip hop, being the Notorious B.I.G.'s nickname. How did you come up with that idea? Where did do you think of doing that sort of style, American style diner, with the sort of Middle Eastern type or Mediterranean type food?
I just it was a bit of a passion project. I thought that I wanted to do something a bit different. I mean, at the stage, sort of high-end QSRs were starting to take shape. I mean, labor laws are pretty strict in Australia, especially in Victoria, and you're trying to find a way to be able to deliver produce or products at volume with measurable wage budgets. So I thought, okay, this is a great opportunity from a business perspective to try to emerge into a new market. And when we did our projections, we thought, okay, we can do this with actually a not a high level of skilled staff, that we need in our other venues. But the reality was, it was probably more of a passion project than it was a commercial, project. And it was something that is still existent, but not in a bricks and mortar store. Now it only really operates for major events and food trucks. But it was a great experience, and I enjoyed it immensely.
Beautiful. And I think one of the things that I was really keen on sharing for our listeners today was around your newest venture, Providor, which I personally got to experience for the first time for my birthday last weekend. And I really, to be honest, had high expectations because of your brand and you being at your restaurant, Maha, for example, so often in my life. But thinking about sort of the concept of having that, normally you get that really negative experience with takeaway food, and so knowing that it was coming from your brand, I was really keen and excited to try it, and it certainly surpassed my expectations. Where was the sort of the catalyst for Providor? Did that coincide with the current pandemic and being able to offer your products even though you had to close your restaurants?
Yeah, look, I mean, we run our businesses quite, I suppose, sustainably. I always keep the businesses quite liquid, so we were in a good position to be able to close down and not have to scurry and try to find ways to make money. And when I like to enter the market to do things, I like to do it quite objectively. So we thought, okay, well, what we've got a premium brand. We don't want to deteriorate that brand. We don't want to serve takeaway food, sort of hot food takeaway, because by the time you get that food home, it's going to be tepid and sweaty, and you've got no real control over it, especially if you're using an existing delivery partner. They don't really care how it gets there. They just want it to get there so they can make their money. So I started thinking about what our customers want, and generally our customers wanted something that they wanted our food, but they wanted the experience that they get in the restaurant. They wanted a high-end experience. And they didn't mind doing a little bit of work, I mean, when I say work, no one has to chop anything, no one has to saute anything. It's pretty easy to put together. But it was more about how can we give our Maha experience in people's homes out to a huge sort of circumference of a radius of Melbourne. So we started working on our food, doing a lot of due diligence and R&D, and worked out that we can actually produce the same flavors, the same quality of food with very little work on the user side. And then I plugged into a friend of mine who had a fruit and veg business, which was, you know, on its knees because nobody's trading. But, you know, a big part of his business is logistics. You know, got 35 trucks. So, you know, it worked out good for him, worked out good for me. He got to keep some of his drivers employed. And we did it on a really sort of small level, just to my database and a Shopify account. And it went gangbusters. I mean, it went absolutely crazy. It was probably one of the most successful businesses I've ever been involved in. You know, and then I thought, okay, well, this is actually a viable market that I could probably grow and help support the rest of the industry. My friend, who the fruit and veg guy, probably didn't have the capacity to take it where it needed to be. So I've investigated and found another logistical partner who actually had a national footprint, who had more reach, more vans, and they were great. They've come on board and they've been amazing. And then I had to look at the platform, and you know, the platform's it's a beast of a platform. It's a multi-seller platform. You know, we had to find the right engine for that, and it's a huge build. I mean, you're several hundred thousand dollars, which, you know, in today's climate, you know, is might as be worth several million dollars. And then obviously bringing all the top tier restaurants on board isn't an easy feat. They're very protective of their brand, and but they trust in me. I mean, I'm not an outside parasite trying to leech off them. I'm a fellow hospitality professional who wants to support these guys. So I think we've established a really good platform. It's unprecedented with the brands that we have and the brands that are coming on in the next few weeks. And I mean, traffic through the site in the last few days has been absolutely ridiculous. So it's at least the restaurants are starting to find a way to connect with their customers and new customers and make some money. But the biggest thing is that we give them a huge reach. You know, we give them a 35-kilometer radius of the CBD, 5 days a week, guaranteed next morning delivery. So the guys aren't just talking to people that they can fit in their dining room. They're actually talking to hundreds of thousands of people that they can, you know, connect with every night.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was one of the most standout things, the fact that your radius is so wide. I also really appreciated the simplicity of it. So receiving the box, which, you know, I didn't know what to expect, but getting it out and actually seeing the instructions that you provided with it was so simple, whether you've got a stovetop, whether you've got an oven, microwave, whatever it might be. And then you've used Cryovac packaging. I'm very familiar with that from earlier career days. So using that packaging has made a significant difference to the way that the food's been received, and tasting it firsthand out of the packaging feels like you are actually in one of your restaurants. So I can kind of see how thinking about those things and thinking outside the box has made a real big difference. I think your overall concept to get your other restaurants on board, to get them to support you, not only are you providing them the platform, but you're actually charging them, you know, only 15%, which is really, really reasonable considering, you know, a lot of other platforms charge upwards of 30%. So how are you finding the whole experience of providing a chef, which is, I know, a new addition that you've added recently, where people can order a chef to come home? How's that sort of been taken with your customers?
Like everything in life, timing's, you know, crucial. The timing of us launching Add a Chef probably wasn't great. We're all in lockdown now again. So, you know, having a chef come to your house and cook a party, you know, a dinner party for you isn't great. I mean, it was more viable when you could have 20 people at home. We saw a huge uptake. Now that we've gone back down into lockdown, it's been a function that we've disabled just out of social responsibility. But, you know, the flip side is we are in lockdown and sales have increased 300% in the last 2 days. So, yeah, where we may have lost the opportunity to be able to create amazing dinner parties in people's homes, we've seen a 300% spike in orders and traffic. So the restaurants are still getting the revenue that they need. And the whole idea of having the Add a Chef was to do two things: to be able to keep hospitality staff employed, because there's limited hours in restaurants now. And this is a way we can keep people going. And, you know, some restaurants were getting, you know, 10, 15 of these orders a week. So it was great. You can employ a lot of people doing that. But also for people at home to have a really sort of opulent at home restaurant experience for a fraction of the price they would have paid in the old world. So it's a great concept and definitely something we'll be bringing back.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the actual concept itself, it seems like it's something that will continue on even when eventually you get to reopen all your restaurants. Is something that will be on offer longer term?
Yeah, this isn't a short-term thing. I mean, I've invested, yes, a shitload of money into this thing. So, and sleepless nights, and I've employed staff. I've got I just employed another staff member today, customer service managers, a digital analyst, a marketing manager, a developer. I mean, you know, I'm not employing these people part-time. These are full-time people. And this will be a business that won't just be around for, you know, the next 6-12 months. I mean, I think this is a different shift in the market. Because I don't think anyone in hospitality is in a mad rush for things to go back to the way they were. You know, the way they were pretty shitty. You know, we had decreasing revenue, decreasing, you know, profit percentages, increasing rents, increasing staffing costs, increasing produce costs, highly competitive market with new people coming on board all the time. So that's not a reality I'm in a hurry to run back to be honest. I mean, the romance of running a restaurant and the buzz and the beautiful dining rooms is one thing. But as a restaurateur, there's not really much of an incentive while you're being sacrificed and crucified consistently by, you know, everybody with a keyboard, the government and, employers union. So sometimes it's better to be able to have something like this where you can create more consistent streams of revenue where you still get to service your customers, but you don't have to run all that gauntlet of, you know, of traps.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I can attest to, not only in your restaurant, but actually using your service last week and actually ordering for MahaGo, was the quantity of food that you get for the price. The value of it is just incredible. We ordered a box for two and found that we had enough food left over to eat the second day as well. So the quantity there, and maybe it's a Middle Eastern Mediterranean thing, it certainly is in the Middle Eastern culture, is really, really generous. So I just thought I'd pass that feedback on. I don't know
It's what our business has been based on. Exceeding expectations is one of our core pillars. And I think that comes in all fronts, you know, in generosity, in humility, in service. But, you know, we've always given a lot of food in the restaurants. And I think that that's a part of culture. You know, yeah. I think that, you know, when you go to your parents' house, come to my parents' house, you don't leave hungry. So you want to make sure we have that when people come to our dining room.
Oh, absolutely. And it was the same at home. And I honestly was very impressed with the quality of the food, and we'll definitely be trying some of the other restaurants like Ginger Boy or Movida as well, which is really exciting. Like I'm blown away by the idea and the concept. And it really is revolutionary. So amazing. And it's amazing that you've actually tested the idea in your own business. The way you've just described that, you tested the concept and, you know, the hypothesis of this and actually found that it works and then shared it with your peers. So kudos to you for that. That's amazing. I'm interested to know around, you've traveled around the world, you've done, cooked in a lot of different countries, and obviously you are amongst a number of really amazing chefs here in Australia, but who do you source for inspiration amongst your peers globally? Is there a particular chef that, you know, you look up to, or maybe someone that you, when you were learning and growing in the industry, is there someone that really stands out to you?
I don't want to sound egotistical or vain, but no one. I mean, I'm not a chef groupie. I'm not I don't follow the chefs. I'm probably the least chefy chef, you know. I don't know who's who in the zoo. And I don't really follow anyone. I mean, I look to people who inspire me are more people who, it's not about their cooking, not about their craft. It's about who they are and what they do in business and what they do in their personal life. So, I mean, I look at people through different lenses. I mean, firstly, I respect people based on who they are as a person and how they treat other people. So, you know, when you talk about people who inspire me, it's generally people who are good people and making change irrespective of their, you know, their sex, their race, their religion, their thoughts or their outlooks. I mean, I don't have to agree with people all the time. And some of the people that I actually admire are people I don't agree with at all. But I admire, you know, their resilience and their passion and their, you know, and I suppose their dedication to their message, whether it's a message I like or not, they're actually true to it. I mean, the whole Trump thing is funny, you know, like he's so conflicting and some of his messages are so ridiculous, but the guy is bloody rock solid on what he believes in, and you know that resonates with me. Now I don't resonate with his messages at all, but you know I sit there and go, wow, that's a bloke who knows what he's on about. But from a cooking point of view, I mean, as a young chef, I just looked at the classic chefs at the time and used to take inspiration from what they were doing. But now, as an older guy, I don't really look at what's happening in the world of cooking.
I guess in the world of business, you'd kind of I'd kind of see yourself in the sort of creating your own blue ocean, if you like, because of all the ideas and sort of the innovation. Not only your cooking skills, which is, you know, second to none, but also on the business side. Where did you get that business know-how? Did you just learn that on the go as you continue to, you know, start opening new businesses and creating these ventures?
Yeah, I mean, I've never been stupid enough to think I know everything. And I'm not vain enough to not ask for help. I mean, I'm very confident in my skin. I mean, I know who I am. And I surround myself with people who are highly intelligent, irrespective if it's emotional or their business smarts. I try to surround myself with people from a lot of different fields. So yes, I've got some good friends who I've worked with over the years who are from the hospitality industry, but my core group of friends are people from, CEOs of major international sporting organizations and, billion-dollar, institutional funds and heads of, radio and TV networks and accounting professionals and, sports stars and, not because of their profile, it's just because these are the people that I'm drawn to. Because they're high achieving, and we see something in each other that we can relate to. There's non-competitiveness. I mean, I don't compete with anybody, and I certainly don't compete with the people that I surround myself with. And I don't seek these people out, and they don't seek me out. We just seem to. I think people are drawn to each other based on who they are and what their morals are. I've been blessed enough that the people that I'm drawn to are good people. So I don't know if it's a reflection on me or a reflection on just what I'm trying to put out, but I think that I've learned a lot from them in regards to business, and I'm never scared to reach out and ask for help and also talk about the things that are going wrong, and I suppose I get a good business acumen from them, but I left school at a young age. I mean, I'm a hustler, I'm a fighter, I've got good street smarts. And I don't think I'm too clever. So I think I think vulnerable leadership's a good way to lead. Let your team know that you're in with the fight with them, that you don't have all the answers, but you also have to be willing to find them. And I'm always out there trying to find the answers.
Very well said. I think yeah, you are surrounded by people, and you sometimes you attract the people that you want to be like, and people that are high achievers is you know, the passion behind it as well. I think all of that sort of stuff, surrounding yourself with those people, you definitely learn a lot. I think that's a very interesting experiences around getting some of that insight from them and taking the bits that, you know, you can work with and making them into something bigger. I think, you know, most people will probably know you from postcards. And I know that at the moment there's not really any travel happening, but for your experiences traveling abroad, what would you say has been your favorite destination and why?
Oh, it's a hard places, and I mean, I love everywhere for a different reason. I mean, I've been blessed to I suppose to work and travel in the places that I love and the people and the cultures that I love. So I mean, I've traveled for holidays, but also I suppose when I think about the professional travel I've done, I mean, I love Middle Eastern and I suppose or North African and Turkish culture. Beautiful people, really, in love with their country. I think patriotism through that part of the world is something that we don't experience here in Australia, and I think that really shows the soul of a people when they love their country. I mean, and they really love their country. You go through Turkey, there's Turkish flags everywhere. You go through Lebanon, there's Lebanese flags, and it's beautiful. I mean, it's really nice to see a country that is proud of who they are. Even when there's a divide, I mean, there seems to be a patrioticness that just can unify. I think for a holiday, I've really enjoyed sort of the south of Spain and Andalusia. I mean, it's so beautiful because it blends Europe and the Middle East. It's got
Yes.
that beautiful North African Moorish flavor and culture with pork and alcohol.
You're not getting that in some Middle Eastern countries, that's for sure.
I mean, so it's kind of got the best of Europe, and the best of the Middle East. And for me, it was just so liberated and beautiful. And it's if anything, it's the one place I've been to that's trying to achieve that has achieved what I'm trying to from cuisine, where it's sort of holds the Renaissance and the romance of beautiful Middle East and North African food, but then it's also been unshackled by, you know, being in Europe. So that's great. But I also think as a country as a whole, I think Turkey is beautiful. I mean, it's such a big country, so diverse, you know, from Central Anatolia to the Black Sea and all down the Bodrum Peninsula. Such a big country with such strong patriotism and a beautiful, you know, food and I suppose world culture. It's a pretty special place.
Beautiful. I did get the chance to go to Spain, although from a Lebanese background, haven't had the chance to go there, to my parents' disappointment. But Spain, what took me aback was not only the cuisine, but even the fact that they would start having dinner 9, 10, 11 p.m. at night, which was quite interesting. But it was a good experience. So it sounds amazing. I think one of the things that I'm curious in understanding, I know you have, you know, you've probably seen and been involved in the many cooking shows. And one of the questions I was talking with my husband about, we're big foodies, we absolutely love all your restaurants and just absolutely love food in general. And one of the things we find really interesting is that usually you're watching one of these cooking shows and in the last 10 minutes, it feels like there's an hour of work, but somehow they managed to get it done in the last 10 minutes. How do you manage under that sort of pressure? It's just mind blowing. And is that a fair depiction of what actually happens in a kitchen?
It's all timing. I mean, I think that with whether you're cooking professionally or you're cooking at home, it's about timing and planning. And yes, it does all come together at the end because it's like life. You know, if you've prepared yourself properly, when it's time to perform, you can just lift to the occasion. It's just the same in cooking. If you do your preparation properly, and then when it's time to serve, you're ready. And like, I mean, my wife says the same thing. She goes, we'll be cooking at home and then all of a sudden the dish is ready. I don't get how that happens. I'm like, well, I've done the preparation right. I haven't tried to start cooking while I'm still chopping vegetables. Like, I've chopped my vegetables, I've weighed out all my stuff, I've washed all the dishes in between, you know, and then it's all that's left for me is just to cook everything in the pan, wash the last two pieces of crockery, and then I'm done. And yeah, I mean, I suppose it does look like it just how it comes together in an instance, but it's just about preparation. I mean, I think about, I've been in the industry for 24 years and there's no chance I would have been able to pivot the way we have with Providor if I hadn't, you know, done all the preparation over the last 20 odd years. And it's just the same as when you're putting together a dish. You need the right ingredients you know, you need to find the right customer.
Oh, wow. Beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. I'm going to have that in mind every time I go in the kitchen and actually do some preparation work up front rather than trying to do it all the way through, which is kind of the way I fumble through it. With regards to kitchen, I'm sure that you've had some kitchen disasters. I'd love to know about maybe a disaster in the kitchen, maybe even in your early apprentice days or even more recent. Can you tell us about a example of something that maybe didn't go very well in the kitchen?
Oh, there's things that don't go right all the time. I have to be honest. I mean, I'm not in the kitchen every day cooking now. I mean, I work more closely with my head chef who creates all the dishes with me. So he's in there testing it. But I suppose the last time I was cooking in the kitchen and something went wrong, I'm trying to think. Well, actually, I mean, I remember being stitched up. So when I was early on in my career, I was just starting out. It would have been the first couple of years of my apprenticeship, and my head chef said to me, look, I'm going to entrust you with something really important. I need you to make sure this is done. I'm like, okay, what is it? No problem, chef, whatever you need done. And he gave me these like little clear, look like filters, and he goes, these are microwave filters. I had no idea, I was a kid, very gullible. These are microwave filters. You need to put these through the dishwasher. Make sure you put one tray on top of the other tray. A commercial dishwasher, you need to put like trays through. Mm-hmm. Because if the water goes through and these things flip around the dishwasher and we lose them, they're worth $1,000 each. And I mean, this was back in like 1996 or something. So I mean, $1,000 each, I mean, I would have died. I was only earning 160 bucks or 180 bucks a week. So I did what he said, put them in there. I waited at the other end of the dishwasher for them to come through. And when they came through, there was nothing there. And I'm like, oh, my God, where did they go? And I'm looking through the dishwasher, pulling it all apart, trying to find where these things went. And then I went back to the chef, and I had to tell him, Chef, I don't know what happened. I did everything that you said, and I can't find them. And they were laughing their asses off, and they'd stitched me up. because they weren't microwave filters, they were sheets of gelatin. And then by the time they went through the dishwasher was hot and it dissolved them, and they just wanted to play a joke on me. So, I mean, look, it wasn't something that went wrong. It was something that went wrong for me, but I mean, I'll never forget it.
Oh my God, you would have been adding up how much thousands of dollars you would have had to pay back and
Yeah,
how long
I
you would
know.
have had to
And you know what? It was bad at the time and it was all that kind of stuff. And I think about it now and I laugh. But I mean, if you were to do that to somebody now, you'd be charged for bloody some kind of emotional harassment. And, you know,
Yep, some deregulation. Yep.
it's a sad state of affair that you can't even have a joke with your staff members without being worried about being sued. But,
Yeah, absolutely. It's changed a lot. Definitely, even in the corporate space where I'm from, it's changed a lot over the
yeah,
years. So you
not
got to be careful with jokes.
necessarily for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful. Well, I guess just a couple of sort of business related. You've got so much things on the go from the books that you do and your restaurants and your TV appearances and previous work with events when they were happening and whatnot. Is there any organization tips that you can share, like being a CEO and being busy? Like, is there anything you can share that helps keep you organized?
I mean, I think that the best thing is a routine and a structure is really important. I wake up every morning and I look after my physical well-being first. You know, I get up and I go to the gym or I run every morning, and then I have a pretty structured day. You know, I know what my meetings are every week. They're formalized every week. And I keep a very detailed calendar for every day. Like if I find that I've got a day where there's 2 or 3 hours that aren't scheduled, then I'm not performing. You know, I'm not I'm not getting what I've done what I need to get done. So, there's always been one sort of thing that I've held my hat on, and I won't go to bed at night knowing I didn't achieve something because I didn't try hard enough. I mean, I use every spare second there is in the day to get things done. And I think this whole notion of work-life balance is for losers. I think that if you're worried about work-life balance, then you haven't got your eyes on the prize. You can worry about balance later. If you've got an opportunity now, now's the time to hustle. You want to take a break, someone else is going to run past you. So I don't agree with that, and a lot of people disagree with me, and they're the people that I've got in my revision mirror. So I'm not waiting for an opportunity to happen. I'm creating the opportunities for myself. So. I'm happy for people who have that ethos. It means there's more people that I can stay, I can climb over to get to where I want to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Really well said. And that, as I say, while some people are sleeping, the competitors are already several hours ahead in their days as well. So,
100%. Yes, there's
amazing.
two types of people in the world. Those that wonder what happened, those that make things happen. I'm
Yeah,
never going to die
exactly.
wondering.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's evident from your early days when you started writing letters to all the five star, restaurants to get a job there, like that as a younger person to be able to have the foresight to do that. And it seems like you've carried that all the way through your career, which is amazing. Just amongst everything you're doing and the Providor venture and you're rolling postcards and writing cookbooks and teaching online classes, and is there anything that you, well, I'm sure there is a few, but is there anything on the wish list that maybe you're looking at doing in the very near future, or are you just focusing on everything you're doing at the moment and worry about that later?
No, I don't look at the future. I mean, I think that 5, 10 year plans are great, but I mean, I'm not looking that far ahead. I'm looking, you know, for this next week, this next year. I think in this climate as well, it's filled with opportunity. I don't look at this as a negative negative part in our life's journey. I think this is probably one of the most blessed times if we look at it with an open mind. There's tight. I think a lot of the noise is being cleared now. It's a lot more quiet, and you can focus really on achieving some really good outcomes. So. I've got some goals with Providor that I want to achieve, and that's what I'm firmly focused on at this point. I think that this is a really exciting business, and I know I'm not the man to take it where it needs to be, but I can definitely see that there is an opportunity for someone greater than I to take this business to an unprecedented level. So I'm really focused on that.
Beautiful. And it's obviously paying itself off in dividends with obviously the number of customers getting on board and repeat ordering as well, not just the first time, but multiple times over. So that's amazing. Just a few rapid fire questions. What is your favorite meal?
Dinner.
Not going to specify me, that's fine.
I like fur, Vietnamese noodle soup. It's my favorite meal.
Beautiful. And what's your favorite ingredient to cook with? Do you have a favorite?
Not really. No, not really. I mean, I like Aleppo pepper, like pul biber, which is like a Turkish spice. Really enjoy that. I think it brings me, I think I can, it's so versatile, and has a really distinctive flavor. So, and I like that.
And what do you like to do to relax?
I don't relax very often. I do to relax. I like to smoke a cigar. I like to,
Yes.
I mean, gym's good for me. I mean, I really enjoy the gym. It's probably the time that I get a chance to decompress and let go of a bit of, aggression.
Yeah, beautiful. So how can people get involved with Providor? Where would you like them to go to get more information? Should they go to your website?
Yeah, people just jump on Providor, so providor.com.au, and just subscribe to the mailing list. I mean, that'll get you really engaged in what's happening.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with the audience? A call to action, a piece of advice, or a question to ponder?
I think that, I suppose, a question to ponder. I mean, I think that during this whole pandemic and lockdown period, I think if people go back to the way they used to be, then it's been a waste of time, and a waste of time, a waste of opportunity. Use this as an opportunity to, I mean, it's a, don't use it as a throwaway chance to refocus on who you are, not who you want to be. I mean, if you're not who you want to be, then that's, you have to own that. Who you want to be is up to you. So, I mean, if you're not that person, then sort your shit out. But take this as an opportunity to really reflect on who you surround yourself with and why you surround yourself with those people. And if you're content with that, Mabruk. But if you're not, do something about it, because we all surround ourselves with people. And this has given me a real chance to realize that there's a lot of parasites. There was a lot of parasites in my world that were sucking the life out of me. And this gives me an opportunity to focus and create strategies to relieve myself of those people. And it's been very, very, very fulfilling.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's amazing. You're absolutely right. Some amazing inspirational stories and ideas coming out of this period of time. And, it's an opportunity for everyone to do something with it, whatever it is they choose to do and wherever that path takes them as well. So, yeah, very well said.